All right. Well, hello, patrons. Can I talk about my shelves real quick?
Shelve away.
Have you guys been following my shelf thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
It's fucking awesome. I've bought these Criterions because I wanted to watch them, and of course they look nice, but I've never actually like thought, okay, well, I can build a room around my Criterions. So you saw the thing I posted on the thing, right?
Yeah, with the
your
stuff, the thing with the stuff,
thing?
Yeah.
The thing with the stuff, yeah, the graph, the shelves, and yeah, because that's right, your OCD was thrown off, Matt, because it's not totally centered.
It was, although it's funny because I said that, and then I went downstairs and looked at my shelves, and they're off center because of the door.
Yeah, so. That's great. So, I think that once like the shelves are up, they'll look so cool that you won't notice. But now we're looking at doing the other side of the room and putting the TV in there. So we might just like line the whole room with shelves. I mean, is that too much?
No, that's awesome. I've always wanted a room like that.
Yeah, I'm literally sitting in a room exactly like you describe. Our podcasting room is also our media room, and I am surrounded by our library, and it feels fantastic.
Yeah, well, the one thing is there'll be too much media that I can't podcast in there, unless like I do a laptop version or something. So then somebody asked how I'm going to organize them, and that's a big question. I know you guys aren't complete, but right? I know you aren't, Matt.
I'm close. I'm about 90 away.
Oh wow!
Oh wow! Okay, that's very close.
That's full spines, Cole.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Blu-rays.
Yeah.
Well, I should say I have a version of it. You know, I've got a mix
not
of
best
DVDs
version.
And Blu-rays.
Yeah, yeah.
When I started, it was in the DVD days, and there are a ton of those that I have yet to upgrade.
Right.
But I have the title represented in one way or another.
So are you, did you spine number it?
No, I'm alphabetical. I come from a long line of alphabetical folks where when I worked at Waterloo Records, instead of separating by genre and all that stuff, it seems like it was always easiest to help people find things. As long as they knew the name, I knew where to go. And so it's a similar thing here.
How do you deal with the and a in different languages?
Oh.
La and...
the articles go away.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm trying to think of...
Yeah, like Evie Deloney is under V.
La Cienega, is that going to be under C or L?
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's under C.
Okay. Yeah, I'm leaning. Like you, I worked at a bookstore. We were interested in libraries, and I want to be able to find stuff. And sure, I could find a spreadsheet and or look on the Criterion's website and figure out the spine. But I don't want to think like that. I just want to find the movies and watch them.
I go alphabetical by director, and then within the director in chronological order, simply because. I like having, the big names like Ozu and Koreeda and the people that I go back to time and again, or that I have complete versions of. I want to be able to see those all together. There is a downside of like the movies that I have that I might not know who directed them. It's a little bit harder, but I don't have a big enough collection that it becomes problematic.
I'm sure you have a very nice Ozu shelf. I think I've seen it actually.
I have all of the Ozus that have been released in the U.S. and then a couple Japan. I don't have any of the BFI early silent boxes that are DVD only, but yeah, I have a lot of them.
and the arrows. Oh no, and like smaller collections. I'm sorry, like Koreeda, you probably have, I know you have a good bit of them.
Yeah, I have every Koreeda, narrative feature from
one
place
or another.
That's
pretty awesome.
Yeah.
What are you saying, Cole? Sorry about that.
I was saying, and so none of us are by spine number, and so the collective skin of the Criterion Nation is crawling right now.
Well, I would never be by spine number.
None of us organized that way.
Simply because I only have probably 200-300 Criterion. So it would be kind of silly. I would have huge gaps. I think that the spine number really only makes sense if you're going for the whole shebang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a very interesting argument in the group about the collective nature and putting them in bags and stuff. And I don't want to dog that guy because he actually made some good points, but it was stuff I hadn't thought about before. He basically just said that this is a collection. You should. So it was almost like displaying it versus maintaining it, would you say? And he was like saying, put it in boxes and sleeves.
They're all going to rot eventually.
That's right.
Might as well enjoy them.
Fuck it, we're going to rot eventually. Should we put ourselves in boxes?
Yeah. That's what we do, actually.
we actually do. We're
the alphabetical thing is also to keep it consistent with the rest of my collection, so I don't have one thing organized one way and then everything else is...
Yeah.
I do have the Criterion separated out, but, you know, altogether it's 6,200 titles. Oof. So to have one section one way and then the other is a different... method, it doesn't make sense to me.
Now, okay, yeah, so that you almost blew my mind there for a second. So if you had, so I'm going to do Criterion separate and then Arrows separate and Masters of Cinema, all that stuff, but imagine mixing all those together.
That's what I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know I'm all, the whole thing is alphabetical by director because there's a lot of those people, like Corrieta is a good example of that. Like not all of my Corrieta stuff is from one label. So I have Criterion mm-hmm. and Arrow and Japanese. So it would be impossible for me to have those separately. It would negate the purpose of the alphabetical by director.
And that's your method of collecting too. It's because you just yes. want to see everything. You love the director, which I think is cool too. It's
yeah, not I want in terms of building my library, it's important to me to have access to every film that is available from somebody that I know that I'm going to go back to on a regular basis.
It kind of makes sense. You do this podcast called The Complete Pod. Yeah,
it's
so
not a coincidence.
Not a coincidence. Okay. You just looking at your wall one day and thought, okay, idea for podcast. anyway, Matt and, well, Cole and Matt, Cole from Austin and Matt from Boston. I didn't realize that rhymed when it came out of my mouth. How's it going, guys?
Good.
I'm doing well.
Thanks for joining, guys. It's, you guys have been on together on a, like, have we, the three of us, done an OWL show before?
Yeah.
At least a couple. And I think Erica was with us maybe once before.
That was the very first Criterion OWL.
That's right. That's right. Well, Cole and Erica and I, but have Cole and Erica and Matt, have we done one together?
Well, that was, no, that was the first Criterion OWL, was the four of us plus Mark, I think.
Oh my God, I'm terrible. I forgot. It was a long time ago. I've recorded a few. We're on episode 88 now. So yeah, time flies. So okay, just the business end of things. As we record this, we are one away from filling up our benefactors. That's crazy. We barely mentioned it. And probably by the time this comes out, we'll be full. So thank you all for supporting the benefactors. I wanted to shout out the names, and I figure out, we'll have to figure out a way to do that. Some really good people, good friends of ours, have shown their support, and I think they're, you know, they're given a little back by participating in our discussions, and we're given a little, we're going to give them a lot back. So very cool of you guys to do this, and no non benefactors have joined. So I guess we can just move on from there. Anything to say to the benefactors?
Awesome. So generous.
Yeah. Just thank you. We appreciate it so much. I, like you, am amazed that it seems like in the blink of an eye that all of those spots are taken. It just goes to show what wonderful friends we have, basically, how they care about it and actually go out of their way to support what we do. And we couldn't be more grateful.
You like us. You really like us. Yeah, it's been very, very nice and very rewarding. So, and we'll put it to good use. There were some nerves about our our overhead. I got a big credit card bill this week. So, and in fact, now it's trying to figure out how to use the how to pay myself back. So, but that's, those problems are resolved just over time. So, one other announcement. Keith's episode was amazing, and I think you guys are going to respond to that, but I wanted to also announce that Keith's Criterion Completion has joined our network. Now, this is new for us. It's the first show that's not producing new episodes. So he only has, I believe it's 9 episodes, is that right?
Yes, and I hate that he didn't do a 10th.
Well, so
of all here's the people to betray me.
he's pretty much indicated he has no interest right at the moment of recording, and I don't think he'd mind me sharing this, but someday he might get the itch, or you know, there might be a topic he wants to explore, and also, you know, he thinks that we're filling a lot of holes. I think he said this on the episode, so he doesn't really feel the need to record one. But if the opportunity presents itself, it's always going to be on our servers, and he could just go to town. So hopefully he'll get that itch to scratch, and if not, he can just, you know, talk about it with us. And I will also say that that he has asked to be on the show to when we actually get Spine 1000 announced. So he can either, I think the way he put it was he wants to gloat or eat crow. So anyway, it was a big, bold statement. I thought it was really a great podcast moment for us too. But did you guys have thoughts on Mr. Keith? I'll ask you first, Cole.
I loved it. It was so fun to hear him just, you know, you basically just let him off the leash and all this stuff comes tumbling out. And with every detail, I thought, yeah, that's better. That's even better. And I can't come up with anything that seems more likely than something like that. I literally have been thinking, we all have. We've been thinking about it for months now, what might be coming. And I cannot come up with anything that makes more sense than that. I came up with an outlandish idea, if you're talking wishful thinking, but I can't come up with anything realistic that makes more sense than what Keith said. It was so fun to listen to.
It's got to be Pink Floyd, The Wall. It's that's what it is. Yeah. And I didn't really, I don't know if you could tell this during the, as he was getting into it, I didn't really realize where he was going or what he was doing. So like, you know, I didn't know that he'd prepared this big thing. So I thought it was like a discussion, and then I was like, Ooh. And I kind of just shut up, and yeah, it was really special to be on the other side of that. Matt, what do you think? Validity. Could this happen?
It could definitely happen. I've been, I think, beating the Citizen Kane as Spine 1000 drum perhaps louder than anybody, simply because...
Look at you, big man.
Well, no. I'm saying, I mean, he disagrees. He says it's 1001. I can't think of another single title that would be more apropos. After hearing Keith's theory, I have to say I am less bullish on Citizen Kane as Spine 1000, not necessarily specifically because of Keith's theory, but because I was thinking about it, and the problem that I have with it being Spine 1000 is simply that I don't know a single person who would be really, really excited by it. I think logically it makes sense, like from a Vulcan perspective, but I you know, all of us own Citizen Kane. We've seen it 1,000 times. No matter what package they would put together for it, I'm sure it would be nice. I'm sure I would buy it. I would love it. It would be great, but it wouldn't be mind-blowing for anybody. And I guess in this era of Olympic boxes and Bergman boxes, I do have a hard time believing that they would produce something that was predictable and not better than we anticipate. That being said, I think there's probably some holes in and some wishful thinking in what Keith put together in terms of a complete Orson Welles box, or at least nearly complete. But the other problem that I have with it is that if they were putting together a complete Orson Welles box, it must have been in the works for at least a year or two, and I have a hard time believing that they would release Magnificent Ambersons so close to a box like that that Ambersons was going to be included in. So that,
well,
is...
I saw somebody else make that argument, and so the counter argument was that they released Bergman. You know, they released
So they announced Virgin Spring before they announced the Bergman box, but they announced the Bergman box before Virgin Spring was released.
That's right. And also Scenes from a Marriage.
Scenes from a Marriage came out before the Bergman box, but it was announced after the Bergman box was announced. So there are no there were no titles that were released within close proximity to the box itself being announced. Yeah. So
it'd be like if Shame came out 6 months prior and then they
Yeah. So that part of it makes it hard to believe that they would reissue the Magnificent Ambersons in a larger box so close to that release. So I lean towards, first of all, I think Citizen Kane is coming. I think that's pretty certain. So I do think it will be Spine 1000 or 1001. I think that there is probably the possibility of a Janus type box that is a Criterion history box, essentially.
Like an Essential Art House kind of thing?
Exactly. But would include films that are have already been released long ago, some Laserdisc titles that otherwise will never see the light of day. For example, I think that there would be a pretty good chance that King Kong would be included in a box like that with the first ever audio commentary, but would never get a blue spine number because Warners wouldn't want to give up King Kong, especially in the middle of their current MonsterVerse experience. So I think that that would be a strong possibility, that we would see a title for 1000 that isn't necessarily a giant box, but that a box would be released alongside it to commemorate the you know, jump in digits on the spines.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be a big splash regardless. And if it is the Prince of Tides, then people will be disappointed. So I take it you'll be disappointed if it is Kane.
No, I won't be disappointed, but I really, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I've never heard anybody say, oh, I really hope it's Kane. Everybody sort of assumes that it will be because there is no other single title, I think, that would work for it. But I have a hard time believing that they don't feel the same way in terms of everybody has Citizen Kane either on DVD or Blu-ray. Is this really a title that this is certainly a title in terms of reputation that warrants the number, but it's not something that is going to be such a event that, that, you know, it's going to make us forget something like the Bergman box or anything like that.
Right. Well, Matt, just so you hear these words, I hope it's Citizen Kane. although I guess prior to Keith's bold prediction, I hoped it was Citizen Kane, but I hope it's, you know, Keith's version, that the Orson Welles box set would be pretty fantastic. Let's move on from that because we don't know. I guess we'll probably know not this next series of announcements, but the one after, unless they do like a special announcement. Are we agreed on that?
Well, was this August, right? So there's conceivably September. Yeah, there's conceivably three more months.
Well, we're seven spines away, it kind of depends on the Coker situation. So if they somehow released a box with a lot of spines, that could feasibly be actually next month, this coming couple weeks. And so let's talk about that. So since we've been talking about spine numbers a lot, there was some confusion over the Coker Trilogy box. And I don't know if anybody really cares about this. I mean, I guess some of us do, but they had the spines out of order. I think they had the box set, and I could have this wrong. I think the one of the movies had an earlier spine and the box set had a later spine.
No, the box was the same spine number as the second film. Yeah.
That was it. Yeah. So, and then we've reached out to them. I even reached out to them via the press channels and no response. And now they've removed the spine numbers from the box completely. So I don't think any of us really know. It's very confusing, but do we have thoughts and feelings on that?
It will
typically, No, those things. I'm very much, when I come at the Criterion Collection stuff, I am about, did I enjoy the film? I'm just about
right.
watching, viewing. It's about the movie because, you know, if we're just looking at a series of numbers on plastic cases, that could be, you could put anything in those. So those details tend to be significantly less important to me. I know they're a big deal to a lot of the Criterion fans, though.
Oh, sure.
I see that sort of thing, and it just sort of washes over me. As long as I can see the films, I don't care.
Yeah, I forgot we're three people that kind of dig alphabetical, so that says something right there. Matt, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I only care about spines as much as Criterion cares about spines. You know, like 500 being Rossellini and 666 being Devil's Backbone. That stuff is interesting to me. I'm only interested in Spine 1000 because I think they'll do something special for it. But it was odd that they were the same spine, so that aspect of it was just fun to talk about. This will be the first box since BBS that and which was the only box that didn't have a spine number, but the movies inside of it did. So you know, I think maybe they just screwed up in the counting and they want to hit 1,000 when they hit 1,000.
Yeah, I think that's the Occam's razor, most likely. You know, just somebody misprinted something on the website, and maybe they haven't figured out, you know, how they're going to arrange this. But yeah, I guess we'll find out soon. All right, newsletter clue. I think the only thing that we can all agree on is we're glad that this was figured out. Unlike the last one, I was going to say monstrosity, but that's not nice. But kerfluffle, mindbender, at least this one was clear from the beginning. So it's Prince of Tides. What thoughts and prayers do you have about this one, Cole?
I think it's safe to say that everyone was decidedly underwhelmed by this clue. Just out of curiosity, I went to look at the going rate of the Laserdisc on eBay, and I didn't find anyone trying to capitalize on this news with one of those rare first pressings. There are not any of them out there currently. It may take a couple of weeks for the news to circulate and someone tries that, but I only found the $5, give or take, copies out there. So there's been no big speculative market sparked by the announcement. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah, Dice K shared some really interesting information about the Laserdisc, and I read it a little further, it sounds like we'll never know what actually happened with the Laserdisc. Background for listeners: I think it was I might have the spines wrong, but it was like 150 something, and it was Barbra Streisand had some issues with it, and they pulled it, and then they released it again as like 250 something in that vicinity, like maybe 100 something spines later. And the rumor is that she didn't like some things she said on a commentary track and wanted a mulligan, and she also, there was a typo on the box. Now, some of the stories, you know, take it with a grain of salt, say that she was a little bit difficult. I don't really have any strong opinions of Barbra Streisand, but I've heard that in other projects that she might be a tad difficult. So I think it's kind of interesting that with that context that this is coming back, because I think it might have been a little bit of a pain in the butt for Peter and friends. I don't know. Do you have any opinions on Babs, Matt?
I think she's a Kubrick kind of person. Like, I think she really manages her image and material and wants it to be exactly the way she wants it to be, down to the finest detail of like the ad for this movie is on the wrong page of the newspaper and I need you to refund my fee kind of person. This movie, I saw this movie when it came out, and I don't think it's a bad movie or anything. I'll be interested to rewatch it. It's certainly not something that anybody was clamoring for, and probably makes the best case so far that they're going to try to get every Laserdisc title they can back into the Blue era. although there's a few of them I'm praying they never put back out. but I think, you know, this is sort of one of the middle ones. And yeah, I guess, I mean, you know, I think maybe it's a bit of a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing. Like they're like, well, we lived through this. We got to re-experience it. But I think also, you know, that, I mean, it was the same people largely at the top of the company who put out this Laserdisc. So they, yeah. They obviously find merit in the film, and they're, you know, again, they're just trying to get all their previous content back out there.
So any chance of a Barbra Streisand complete series? So I guess Yentl kicks it off.
Well, this did remind me of one of my favorite Oscar moments of Lauren Bacall's face when she lost to Juliette Binoche for The English Patient. But that was for The Mirror Has Two Faces, which is not a good movie. I doubt we'll be seeing anything like that.
Okay. Well, you never know. It would be a short season. I'm a little closer to this movie because I live in the Southeast, and Pat Conroy is a local fixture here where I live. Little past his prime. I mean, his work is not as popular as it was when this came out. And also, I grew up in Atlanta, and there's an Atlanta scene, and then there's South Carolina, so. So maybe I'm a little biased. I don't think it's a bad movie either. I think it's a fine movie. I think some people were calling it like Oscar bait. I don't know that I would actually even say that. I think it was just an adaptation of a drama, and I'd say it was decent. I'm not going to say it's any masterpiece. I'm curious if I haven't seen it since it came out, so I don't know if my take will change. Cole, do you actually like the movie, or...
I actually haven't seen the film, so I think I don't know if I'm in the majority or the minority in that case in terms of just the general public, but somehow this one slipped off my radar even then. I mean, I was aware of the release, but it was never one that was at the top of my list to see, and somehow over the ensuing, 25 years now, I've just never caught back up with it. So it's a good excuse, I guess, for me to visit it for the first time.
Okay, wow. Well, there has been a lot of...
Nick Nolte is really great in it.
Nick Nolte? Yeah. And actually, I think that it's fine. But some people really hate it. So that's one thing that... I think it was probably the most underwhelming newsletter clue in a while, except for the one that nobody could figure out. But so I guess we'll see. I don't know when it'll come out. I'm guessing probably on the other side of Spine 1000. So I'd like to get to Cannes. We wasn't planning to cover it, but I'd say this year's Cannes Film Festival is kind of interesting. I don't know if you all agree, or do you guys really get caught up in the whole thing, the pageantry and all that?
I typically do. Well, the pageantry, maybe not necessarily, but I definitely follow it every year. And I think you're right. Usually, especially when you're talking about the main competition can sometimes just be ho-hum for me. I'm typically more excited by Director's Fortnight and the... a certain regard category, but this year seems to be slightly stronger than average in the main competition. And I think that's all down to the jury.
I think you're right. It was a really strong jury this year. One thing somebody said was that you really can't predict the jury based on like the work they put out, because, you know, people's tastes are all over the place. And there was, what was the year that Daniel Blake won that was controversial? And there's another year or something else won. I think it was 2012. But then there was also Uncle Boonmee. So, you know, sometimes, and I forget who the president was when Uncle Boonmee won, but it was somebody that was, you wouldn't think, it was Joel Cohen, actually, wasn't it?
That I don't remember.
I can't remember. Yeah, well, somebody will correct us. But I think we have some good films here, and I'll focus just on the Criterion connections or potentials. So I think the competition, Parasite sounds like it's amazing. I'd say pretty much little to no chance of Criterion. And I think actually somebody already picked up the rights, right? You guys know?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay.
I think somebody did. And then Atlantix was already picked up by Netflix. The Dardens, now Young Ahmed, they won Best Director.
Neon bought Parasite.
Oh, did okay. So there you go. I don't know what sort of physical media they tend to work with, but yeah, I'm guessing still not Criterion. So the Dardans was pretty much panned, but they won for Young Ahmed anyway. So I wonder if just because Criterion has a relationship, and because it was panned, maybe the Dardans will tinker with it a little bit. Because usually, even though they won the award, if they won the Palme d'Or, they wouldn't. But and then there's a Moldavar. So, and then let's see, there's a Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Got a lot of good buzz. I think that was picked up by Netflix. I forget. Any of these jump out, Cole?
I can't believe those canned savages booed my beloved Dardan brothers.
Can you believe that? I know. I mean, it does pretty much like...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, pretty much maybe the most beloved directing duo. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like that it falls in the category of their more minor works, something like The Unknown Girl, rather than 2 Days, One Night. So I don't know that anyone will be in a hurry to push that to the top of Criterion releases. I'm really interested in the, just based on what I saw of Antonio Banderas' response and performance in that new...
Yes.
Almodovar, it seems like, I think more attention should be paid to their relationship, because he always seems to get the best out of Antonio Banderas anytime they work together. Those are always such career peaks.
Totally.
It seems like, and I'm really intrigued by this. I'm excited to see that. Most of the other stuff, though, it seems like probably a 30-70 chance any of the bigger titles could end up on Criterion. I don't see a lot that's going to go that way. There is one film, though, that's sort of floating around down in the lower margins of that I think would be a great pickup, but I don't know that it's going to happen. Probably my favorite thing that I read of all the coverage coming out of there was about Ghost Tropic, and that seems to fit within your slow cinema stuff. You know, if you've got your Pedro Costa box, you've got similar things to that. I think this would fit nicely in there, and it would be one of those titles that might be a nice, pleasant surprise for people. So I say keep your eye out for Ghost Tropic.
Ghost Tropic. Okay, I'll look for that. Yeah, the Almodovar is actually what I'm most excited about. I think Parasite is probably going to be up my alley in a lot of ways, but it just seems like, and I think it was unanimous. It was very, very highly acclaimed, but the Almodovar, it seems like it's kind of a groundbreaking work for him, and it kind of, you know, maybe punctuates his career, and I think it actually could have more potential to be a crossover foreign film at the Oscars. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's always well loved by the Academy. I'm surprised we haven't mentioned the Malick film at all. And I was surprised that it got picked up so quickly, just considering the lack of commercial success of his previous three movies. But obviously, this is more of a departure.
Or return.
Yes.
Depending on your perspective. Yeah. Yeah. Knight of Cups. Not so much. Who picked it up?
I think it was Fox Searchlight, maybe.
Okay. Well, in 10 years, there might be the 5-hour cut coming to Criterion.
Yeah, it was Fox Searchlight. So this is Malick's first Disney film.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well. Yeah, so yeah, the Malick, it got some attention, but like anything, Malick's kind of divisive.
Yeah, and also, like, I mean, this is probably going to be the best Dardenne movie ever, right? If it got booed at Cannes, I mean.
It could be, yeah. I mean, I'm kind of curious how, when the public sees it, so when our peers see it, you know, how will they take it? Of course, Cannes is... I don't know if it's always a barometer of the film's quality.
Oh, no, it's notorious. I mean, the list of movies that have been booed at Cannes is very close to the list for the Sight and Sound Top 250.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very honorable reputation to be booed there.
Yeah, it is. And I found a link. I'm going to put it in the show notes. There was a Cannes 2019 critics ratings, and what they did is this wasn't just the critics, the people who work for press, but also, you know, just like Letterboxd ratings. And they just accumulated all the takes of the these films, and Parasite was by far number one of the new films. And there are others. Pain and Glory was up there too. Rocket Man was in the top 10, and of course the Tarantino got some attention, even if not any awards. And then what was cool was they had the silvers or the Cannes Classics. So, you know, everybody gave a 10 to Easy Rider and L'Âge d'Or and Los Olvidados, The Young and the Damned. And then, like Canal was up there. Let's see, Miracle Milan didn't get as high of a rating. So yeah, it's kind of these reevaluations. Did you guys see this?
No, I didn't see it.
I did, yes.
Yeah, Tony didn't get a great. I mean, like it got a 7.7 something. So, but you know, for its esteem, I guess.
I'm surprised that Los Olvidados is not getting more buzz from the Criterion faithful. That is 100% coming to Criterion, and that is a big deal.
And so 20 people thought it was a perfect film. That's saying something too.
It's possibly my favorite Buñuel. And it has been treated incredibly poorly over the years. And so this is a major, major WCP restoration, and it's going to look really great. I'm really excited about it. And this is a movie that people have talked about as a possible Criterion rescue for decades. And so maybe it's just because it hasn't been announced far and wide everywhere at this point, but this is going to be a Criterion title, and it's a really good thing.
And maybe just people are distracted by Orson Welles' Fever or what, you know. I want to take it back. Miracle Milan was very well received.
That's a great movie.
Yeah. Love that one, yeah. Kind of that magic realism. And The Lighthouse, actually, the other non-main competition, that one seems like it's really strong. Yeah. And that was... and others, yeah, there was... I'm kind of looking forward to The Art of Cinematic Sound, Making Waves. That got really high marks. And that was a new documentary. And, yeah, there's the Tarantino... I don't know. Anything else there stand out to you,
Cole? Things. I like to think of The Lighthouse as just a crazed extension of Willem Dafoe's Fishing with John episode, basically. So there's a slight Criterion connection there, but we do actually have a legit, very nearly upcoming Criterion collection in Bruno Dumont. His Joan of Arc got the special jury mention in the
That's right.
Certain regard category.
Yeah, and we're about to get a double feature of him. So yeah, Dumont is... for the taking, I think. I haven't been keeping up with acquisitions to see if he, if anybody picked up that or any of the others. But The Lighthouse, I think. Do you guys know if anybody picked that up?
I think it was already.
No.
Like, because that was out of competition, right? I think that was already being distributed by somebody.
Yeah, you're right. I think so. So, all right, well.
Yeah, it's an A24 movie.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, I mean, that's definitely not going to be Criterion, but I will definitely see it, and pretty easily. So there was a new Janus page for a movie called Streetwise by Martin Bell, 1984. I got nothing on this film. I hadn't even heard about it until this week, but apparently it's going to get a Janus tour. Either of you guys, do you know it?
Only by reputation. I'm excited to see it. It really reminds me of that early Larry Clark Tulsa photography stuff in that way, and it also seems like it will be, you know, the perfect double feature for My Own Private Idaho.
Huh, but this is documentary though, right?
Yes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it looks very interesting. I just didn't know it. Matt, do you have anything?
Yeah, I watched it a couple months ago. I think it was on Canopy. It's not there anymore. It's a very interesting and emotionally affecting film. It's also, I think, a good pairing with Paris is Burning, even though they are opposite sides of the country and very different characters that it covers and scenes that it covers. My biggest problem with the film is that a lot of it felt false to a certain degree. If some parts of it felt a bit like recreations or stagings, and there were just, I think, some moments that took me out of the realism of the film. But I think the characters are very memorable and very affecting, and it's you know, I think certainly a worthwhile film. Paris is Burning is significantly better, you know, Paris is Burning is also pretty spectacular. So I think, you know, so I'm much more excited about that than about this, but it's definitely not a film that I would want to see forgotten. So it's worth seeing for sure.
Cool. Okay. Well, I guess we'll get to see it. So buckle up. I see it has an 8.2 on IMDb. So that's, but only like 1400 ratings. So we'll see. Want to switch gears off of that. I want to get into more of the physical versus streaming video. Well, one thing actually, I'll just kind of like put out there that Home Theater Forum is going to interview Lee Klein at Criterion. And I don't know if you guys saw that, but they just basically are, and Home Theater Forum's been around for like, I don't know, 100 years, basically. And they have a big community there, but it's not disc specific. It's more just about like home theater. Like they just had their users post questions and they're going to do a podcast episode. I didn't know they had a podcast. Did you guys see this? Good get.
Anytime that they open themselves up to, I always cringe at the idea of any public Q&A. So I like the idea that they're going to vet these questions first. But yeah, it's a fantastic thing that they're opening up. We've got this avenue for just the general consumer to essentially communicate directly with them and get some answers to some of these questions that I'm sure quite a few people have.
Yeah, I kind of perused some of the questions, and there's some good ones there. I could tell there were a few that they're just going to not touch. I'd be curious. I'd love to see, like, it will never happen, but I'd love to see Lee Klein or Peter Becker do like a Reddit AMA. I think that's one of the few times I'd really love Reddit. Not that I have problems with Reddit, but did you see this, Matt?
Yeah, I did. It's so rare we hear from the technical side of things outside of the recounts of what goes on in Columbus. So it's nice to hear, you know, directly from them, the answers to some of these questions.
When it gets posted, we'll share it here in our social media. So I'm curious to see it. I'm sure we'll have some thoughts from his answers. Lee Klein is actually really, really forthcoming. He used to do the Wexner talks. Well, and Peter was there often as well. So I think we'll get some good stuff from that. So that was very cool of them to do it. There's also streaming media. Canopy is very, very interesting. So one of our listeners posted that Harris County, Texas, canceled their Canopy because of the prices. This was Justin that posted this, and Josh. I'm sorry, sorry, Josh. Canopy is really, really expensive for libraries. I think that's become a misnomer. I know Matt, you're a big Canopy advocate and a consumer. What are your thoughts?
Well, I've actually slowed since I heard the prices. Although I think what Canopy is really expensive for is educational libraries. Like college libraries and things like that, because the pricing is different. So if they stream if you stream a title three times, they have to pay the educational license fee for it. So it's like $150 or something like that per title. I think it's apparently it's an individual rental fee for each thing, and then there, you know, each library system can impose a limit per person on how many rentals they have per month, to sort of limit their balance, balancing, but the budget. But I think it is, I am always uneasy with, the idea of a commercial company, charging some middle person and not allowing the consumer to see the true price of something, I think is when it becomes difficult. And obviously, like, I love my library system. I don't want to be an undue burden on them when I could be just borrowing discs from their collection as it stands for a cheaper price for them. So I do think twice before I get anything on Canopy. But, you know, I mean, at the same time, they're offering that service because they want people to have it. So if, the, you know, it gets too expensive for them and they drop it, I'll somehow carry on with my difficult options in the streaming world. It's always hard to find something to watch, right?
And yeah, there's so little selection out there. So, Cole, does your library have Canopy at all?
We do, and I definitely take advantage of it. Ours is one of the systems where there is a 5-title limit per month. So, yeah. You know, I can only make a $10 dent in the Austin Public Library's budget. But if there are thousands and thousands of people out there like me doing that, yeah, it's one of those things where Canopy seems really great on the surface, like Matt said. And when you dig into the nuts and bolts of all this pricing, it does make me hesitant to use it. It's been fantastic for me in terms of, it's been so helpful with my New Year's resolution to watch 50 African films, for instance. You can find a lot of titles there that you can't find somewhere else.
You can.
Yeelan was on there, you know, far before it was available on the Criterion Channel, for instance. And so I'm really torn about it. I certainly don't want to negatively impact the library system that I love so much, but the convenience of it, I can see why people would be drawn to it initially. And also, it was really interesting, that article that you linked to us talking about how deceptively it was marketed in the first place.
Yeah. And I'll put that in the notes
as well.
That was, yeah. They're like, it's free. And it's not. Not at all. Yeah, that was in Film Quarterly. So I'll put the in there. And you're just down the street from Harris County. I mean,
Yeah. I'm only a couple hours away.
And that's a large population center. So I could see that there probably were thousands and thousands of people. And it does add up. And it, the fact that you have 5 is telling. My library has 10.
Mine
and,
too,
Not bragging about that. That's actually, that seems like a lot. I've noticed my consumption has minimized since the Criterion Channel has launched, just because there's, but during that gap between Filmstruck and Criterion Channel, I was pretty much a power user for Canopy. But yeah, I kind of take for granted all the Oscilloscope stuff shows up there. All of A24 is there. And then you have a lot of obscure gems that are hard to find, and a lot of Criterion stuff too. So, and then speaking of things shutting down, iTunes is shutting down. And now this, I think, impacts music more a little bit, because it kind of sounds, well, so we're recording this the day before I think they're actually officially going to announce this. So the devil's in the details, but it sounds like that they're going to stop selling albums. So that's the big, you know, like the $9.99 albums are instead going to push it towards their kind of like Spotify. But I thought about movies. So if, and now probably very, very few of us buy Criterion's or other movies on iTunes, or, but I can't see them shutting that down. I don't know.
Aren't they dividing it up into different apps? Isn't that the idea?
Yes.
Yeah, they're gonna
3 sections.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It's kind of a pain to shuffle back and forth between them, and they don't. None of them really work as well as they could on their own. So that aspect of it kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah, kind of like just you have a podcast team, and you have a I think they already have that, actually. But you have a music team, I think it's TV and movies. So yes, maybe there's less to that. So okay.
Well, no, I mean, I just, as somebody who like has 4,000 albums, and like I have spent most of my life on iTunes. I always wanted like a pro iTunes account where you could have more functions, because like I really spent a lot of time organizing my iTunes and keeping it. So this is like the end of an era for me as like an old millennial, but I do I mean, I don't use it as much as I used to, and I do think like it was always very clunky, even with the relaunch. Mm-hmm. And so I, but it's hard to let go. It is definitely the end of an era for me.
So does that make you feel weird? I'm sure you probably stream. I don't know if you use Spotify.
I have Apple Music. Yeah, so I use Apple Music now to get new music and things like that. But I still have my previous collection. Basically like hooked up to my Sonos system.
Okay.
At my house.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff that I have that's not available on Apple Music.
So you're 4,000, you paid for 4,000 titles that, yeah.
Well, not through iTunes. I ripped them from CDs. Yeah.
I see. Okay. So yeah. All right. So life's a music. I did the same. So I had towers of CDs. So, all right. Well, yeah, the streaming media versus physical media, I think it looks like maybe not changing too much in the near future, but at some point it will. All right. Well, should we get into the June lineup, or just kind of mention, are there any highlights since we're almost to June, or we're actually in June now? Anything jump out here that you would recommend people pick up? What's your film trilogy, Swing Time, Bruno Dumont, Hedwig, and War and Peace?
I was very disappointed by the Swing Time DVD Beaver screenshots. They did not look that different than the previous Blu-ray.
Matt, are you going to be a pixel?
I thought they would make it look like it was brand new, and it didn't look that way to me. But I will wait for the disc to you know, confirm. But I mean, especially in comparison to the War and Peace screenshots, which were amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah, well, it's not teal, so there's that. War and Peace, I think is, yeah, that's the one I just had my calendar marked. That's actually right in the player. I mean, it'll stay in the player probably for a week or two.
I'm going to go see it in the theater. It's coming to Brattle here. I'm going to take a day off of work and go watch it.
I envy you. I try to get it here. Actually, my film, they wanted to get it here, but things changed. What about you, Cole? What do you think of June?
Humanity and War and Peace are the two big ones for me. Humanity I've seen and I really love, and War and Peace, obviously, I haven't, but of the Dumont choices, I think Humanité is definitely the stronger one. Since La Vie de Jesus is a first effort, it shows that from what I've read. I haven't seen it, but it seems to have all the hallmarks of a first film. But Humanité, if you're like me, you like, you know, skewed police procedurals, and the way that Dumont is confrontational with the audience, not necessarily in such a cruel way as someone like Haneke, but still very definitely pushes you to your limits sometimes. It's really good for people who enjoy that experience. And then War and Peace. Mm-hmm. This is the only one that's a complete unknown quantity to me, both the film and the filmmaker's body of work. So I love it when we get these epic and historically significant discoveries or resurrections. This stuff like Gonson's Napoleon, all those feel like huge spectacular gifts. Yeah.
Are they going to show it in Austin?
I don't try know. To I haven't checked my calendar for a while because I've been a little busy. I think it may have come and gone already. I'm not sure. But if they show it, I will be there front and center.
Yeah, I think it's a strong month. And I think that these are all going to be straight into the players. I think for me, the Dumont's even. I'm really looking forward to those. So, and then we have the channel June lineup came out. One thing I noticed is Hedwig's already on the channel.
All are.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, but Hedwig was actually displayed in the now playing or whatever. Anything jump out on Criterion Channel for June?
All of it.
I'm sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
No, that's all I had to say. All of it.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I look at it, and you've got a Pitchapong Veracetacool block. You've got that Dorothy Arzner block, which I think is going to be really fun, especially I think it's Dance Girl Dance that is probably at the top of that list. All those Decline of Western Civilization movies, the Kieslowski box.
Yeah, this would be good.
Nicholas Rogue is on there, whom we just lost 6 months ago. There's that huge Alec Guinness Ealing comedies block. There's so much.
Yeah, yes. Oh, that's great. Yeah. There's also the Plague Dogs. I'm looking.
Yeah.
haven't seen that, and I think I missed my boat. It was streaming somewhere, and then it went away, so nobody told me. Yeah, it looks pretty amazing. There's some regattas. So yeah.
Warning to anybody who's going to watch The Plague Dogs: it's extremely disturbing, and not for anybody who's into or who really loves animals, has a hard time with animal, like intense animal experiences.
Okay, unlike Watership Down, which is very, very pleasant, and
it makes Watership Down look like a kid's movie.
Okay, all right, that's fair. Yeah, I can't wait. I would love to see a Criterion edition, but it did get a physical release from somebody else.
Yeah,
I want to say Shout.
Yeah, or I have it.
Shout. Yeah. So yeah, and hopefully I don't know. I'll have to ask Josh the status of his Criterion Channel show. I know he's at a film festival right now, but I'm curious to hear his thoughts. All right. Well, if you don't mind, let's get to some short takes. Just talk about something we've watched recently. So, Cole, I'll start with you. What have you watched?
We got to see The Lady Vanishes on the big screen not too long ago, and it was such a fun experience.
That's fun.
Always fun to see those things that come out of a trip to the theater versus watching at home. And with this viewing, I was really pleasantly surprised at how funny it seemed this time. I've always thought about it as breezy and a good bit of fun and adventure, but the comedy in it was really standing out to me this time, and it's really first rate. It's so full of clever jokes, and half of them that Michael Redgrave almost delivers as asides, so I can see how I've missed them maybe before, but that guy's comic timing is impeccable. I didn't appreciate that enough about him before. You know, the Browning version is not exactly the funniest movie ever, so... But Charters and Caldecott, those guys are a gas. And I love the miniatures of the village that opened that film. So it's even cooler to see on that scale. It was super fun.
And you know, I think Hitchcock doesn't get his due. And we kind of talked about this on the Notorious episode for Close-Up. But there is some comic timing, but you just tend to remember, you know, the suspense and the MacGuffins and all that. So yeah, I haven't. It's been a few since I've seen *Lady Vanishes*. It's one of my favorites. It's such a great movie. What about you, Matt? You got a short take?
Yeah, I finally watched 24 Frames, the last Kiarostami movie, or Kiarostami, I think is the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Matt.
I bought it because I have all of his films from Criterion. I think he's one of my favorite directors of my lifetime, and I thought this was a really beautiful and fitting final film from him. I love final films. I just think there's something about them that, especially when it all comes together like this one does, it just feels like a perfect summation of his career, in the same way something like Matadayo did with Kurosawa. But I think it's certainly not going to be for everybody. It's an extremely slow film. But if you are in the mood to just sort of get enveloped in something and just kind of live in the world, I think it's a really wonderful experience. And I can't wait to watch it again. I think it's a real treat. I'm really happy to have it.
So kind of like a meditation in a way?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you haven't seen it yet, I mean, it's basically, it's the moments before and or after a photograph that Kiarostami took at some point in his life. There's 23 of those. The first one is actually a painting rather than a photograph. He started off with the concept being paintings, but then switched to photographs afterwards. It's basically like a moving photograph. Some of them pan, a few of them zoom, but mostly it's just a frame and there's things going in and out of the frame. And the sound design is spectacular. I really love that aspect of the movie. Most of them are in nature. So it's a lot of animals of different kinds, different things happen. Each one is, I think, 3.5 or 4.5 minutes. So, you know, it, not a lot happens in this movie. There's no plot. You know, it's very much like each one is a series. But it's, if you are in the mood to just meditate and zone out, it's perfect for that.
Cool. Well, I've heard that it's a movie that cats will like. Yes. Because there's, maybe it's because of the animals. So
it's just the whole thing. It's very peaceful, slow moving. Things develop gradually over time. I'm not surprised cats like it. They also have very good taste in movies. So
that's a cat's attention span is they like that slow build and then the attack. All right. Well, mine is actually, I'm glad I'm have Cole and well, actually both of you guys for this. So mine is House of Games, David Mamet. I think I'd seen it, but I hadn't remembered it. And Cole, I remember how much you hate Lindsay
Krause.
And I kind of get that.
Just in
kind of get it.
Just that performance.
Just in that film. And I don't know if it's intentionally stilted a little bit but I definitely saw that. And Matt, I think you just didn't like it. Is that right?
No, I like House of Games. I don't like Homicide.
Okay.
I think House of Games is good.
I haven't seen it. I thought House of Games was pretty good, but really the special part for me was the commentary with Ricky Jay, and I think that Cole, you kind of put him more on my radar than he was, or I knew him as an actor, but I didn't know the extent to which the magician, and really just this is about con jobs. It's kind of a different animal, but still in that same family of deception. I love that he was I think he was credited as con artist consultant or something like that. I watched the movie and I enjoyed it. And then I rewatched it almost immediately, this was actually, showing discs. And I just pretty much listened to the commentary as a podcast, and Mamet's okay. He's a fairly interesting guy and had a lot of beef about Orion, but Ricky Jay, just hearing him talk about, how he, his experience with not just the card games, but these takes. I kind of wonder how much he's actually done in his life. I don't think he's done a con like anything to the extent in which happens in this movie, or at least the main plot. But maybe some of the smaller ones. So yeah, really enjoyed it. It was like it was the same commentary as the DVD. Ricky Jay is. Well, I was going to say Ricky Jay is magic, but. Really entertaining guy. So thank you, Cole.
Hunt down Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants on YouTube. It's real pleasure.
Yeah. I think that's the one that Cole mentioned.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Absolutely. If you want to see unparalleled card handling skill, that guy is just up head and shoulders above everyone else, I feel like. And also, the thing that I think you are probably reacting to in the commentary, in addition to that, I mean, he's not just a magician. He's a historian and a storyteller.
Yeah.
He's such a compelling guy to watch and listen to. And his knowledge is just encyclopedic when it comes to the history of anything having to do with that type of deception. Even stuff beyond that. Carny stuff, religious history. He knows so much. There's a great book, if you like Ricky Jay. There's a book he wrote called Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women that I cannot recommend highly enough. It's a fantastic book.
The great thing about the special, too, is that he uses that knowledge of history of deception to do his tricks. So he's distracting you with the information about these people who deceived people in order to deceive you. It's pretty impressive.
He's brilliant. And I love how he, one of the things he said in the commentary is that like the best marks were scientists or professors, people that are generally really smart, but they also know they're generally smart. And so it's easier to deceive them and make it is interesting. And of course, I think he was always the smartest man in the room, just about. So, all right. Well, that's kind of a borderline piece of flair too, but do you guys have a piece of flair? Cole?
Yeah, I do. We were lucky enough. We went to a lecture and an exhibit about Norman O. Don a couple of weeks ago, who was a special effects pioneer. And when I say pioneer, he was the first director to use rear projection.
Oh, wow.
And he also revolutionized matte shots and glass shots. He was constantly refining that process. The coolest thing about this was the Harry Ransom Center, which is here on campus at University of Texas, they have 164 of what he called his cards. They're kind of like oversized scrapbook pages, and each one of them, he outlines how he achieved a given effect, and they're really incredible pieces of mixed media. They're about the size of a newspaper folded in half, and so in one corner, you'll have a little postcard-sized oil painting of the effect, and then typewritten notes, pieces of film negatives, pencil sketches. They're just a really neat film history lesson, basically preserved by the guy who invented what became movie magic. And this was a guy who, previous to that, was unknown to me. So it was just like a bolt out of the blue to realize, wow, this guy invented these things. And it's, you know, some of the things on those cards only exist in that particular piece of media, you know, a piece of film negative from a film that's long since lost because he worked majority in the silent era. But yeah, it was so fun to get to see literally the wellspring of these techniques.
What was his name again, Cole?
Norman O. Dawn, D-A-W-N.
I'll check it out. I think that we need a documentary about him, and we need one about Ricky Jay. Like a really comprehensive documentary about them. What's your piece of flair, Mr. Matt?
My piece of flair is that I've been watching Ruben Mamoulian's films in chronological order through DVD Ooh. From the library and streaming and all the weird places that I can find them. He is a director who's probably most famous for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Frederick March.
Certainly.
And he made a number of really great films in the pre-code era, and then some interesting silent remakes like Blood and Sand in the 40s. And his career kind of petered out primarily because of the Blacklist. He was the president of the DGA in the late 30s, had a really interesting career. He also got fired from Laura. He was the original director of Laura, and then Otto Preminger fired him and replaced him with himself.
Didn't know that.
And but I really just want to recommend his first run of films, his pre-code films. Applause is really spectacular, his first movie. I mean, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde has some really interesting stuff going on in it as well. And Queen Christina, the Greta Garbo film, is a really fun watch, and she's really special in it. And he also made a movie called Love Me Tonight, which is basically like, it is a Lubitsch movie, but Lubitsch was busy directing Trouble in Paradise. And so this is Mamoulian's take on a Lubitsch musical, and it nearly bests all of Lubitsch's musicals, I think, for just pure Lubitsch charm and inventiveness and sort of just delightful camera work. And I think it's probably the best new movie that I've seen this year, and I really highly recommend it. It's around on DVD, and it's a really great watch. So check out some early Mamoulian.
I'd like to. I've only seen Jekyll and Hyde and Queen Christina, and I think I've talked about Queen Christina on the show before. What was interesting is that I forget the name of the leading man had come out of the silent era, and his career was doomed, but then Mamoulian resurrected him. I forget his name, but I guess he didn't have the best voice or something, but yeah, Garbo's amazing, and that final shot is still one of my favorite shots in cinema history. Are they pretty easy to find, these other films?
For the most part, they're available on DVDs that are pretty cheap. Love Me Tonight, I think, came out from, I think it was Kino, maybe 15 years ago. So I'm hoping that gets a better release. They're around. Very few of them are on Blu-ray. I think Becky Sharp, which was the first Technicolor film, three-strip Technicolor film ever, is available on Blu-ray. However, it's bad, but it's fun to look at least. It somehow manages to make Miriam Hopkins boring, which I didn't think was possible. they're around, and all of his pre-code stuff I think is worth seeing.
Yeah, well, and I know his later work, I seem to remember he did a Zorro movie.
He did,
that was
yeah.
pretty good. Yeah, so great director. Yeah, I think he's kind of underappreciated.
Definitely.
Not on Criterion. And yeah, maybe they can rectify. Maybe Spine 1000 will be a Memorial box, pre-code box. Well, mine is more modern, well, kind of. It's a modern reflection on history. So I saw Apollo 11, and you can't help but compare it to For All Mankind, which is probably one of my favorite space documentaries, maybe my favorite space documentary. But Apollo 11 is an interesting experiment because what it does is it's a 90-minute documentary, roughly, but it shows you kind of the narrative without dialogue of what happened. So there's no talking head in interviews. It's pretty much just the news footage, pretty much all news footage. But the way they cut it together is very well and it very interesting, and it encompasses the entire narrative of the launch and the tension on the ground, and then of course the astronauts' experiences, and but it's their own words as it happened rather than reflecting later. So it's neat. It's not as good as those. It's better than First Man. I'll say that. Have you guys seen it yet?
No. And I haven't seen First Man either.
The only one I've seen that you mentioned is For All Mankind, which I think I'm like you. I love that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of additive. This doesn't take anything away from that. This is just a different perspective on it. But I think it's actually a great movie to celebrate this anniversary of going to the moon, where we haven't been there lately, just FYI. And seeing, you know, how I guess challenging it was for the time. And I think the real story captured is far more interesting than First Man. I know it has its fans, but yeah, not one of them. So that's Apollo 11. So that's the show. Thanks, gentlemen. Looks like we kind of a quicker show. That's good.
I was afraid we were going to go on forever. When I saw that can lineup, I thought, oh, that'll take an hour right there.
Yeah, well, the Spine 1000 could have as well.
Oh, I didn't get to tell you my crazy idea about Spine 1000. I was inspired by Keith.
Throw that in there.
And I went back and my idea, just to make the most outlandish landmark thing ever for Spine 1000, I wanted them to do a total Eclipse of the Heart set was my idea. They released that Luis Garcia Berlanga eclipse set that they teased, along with three other sets to be named later, to bring that imprint up to 50.
50.
And they put all those on blue.
Oh.
And it comes in a huge package in either a solar or a lunar variant. It either comes packaged in a big sun or a big moon. And you make it the centerpiece of your living room. And then the eclipse imprint is retired.
Oh, that's my God. That's like two. You're talking 250 movies.
Yeah. That would be like $5,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not only a box set, it's also a coffee table. Yeah, that's pretty out
there. It's an actual eclipse if you put it up.
Well, yeah, we did have one of those. Was it last year or year before here? Yeah, I do kind of wonder if maybe after they get this out of the way, maybe the eclipse will get a little more attention now that this is kind of a big milestone. I would love to see some eclipse in November.
We need one this year. Yeah, please. One. At least
just one. Yeah. Yeah, and Berlanga would be a great candidate. So, okay, well, you can find us on all of our shows on the 25th Frame Network. So that's Magic Lantern and The Complete Podcast, and this one, of course. And you guys have your own feeds as well. So, and Cole, what are you doing online these days?
Online these days, not a lot, it feels like. I'm just trying to keep up right now with the demands of the new job, and then also trying to get all my other social media stuff in the margins. Aside from, you can find us at @lantern_cast on Twitter. If you tweet at me, I'll try to get back to you as soon as I can. I won't be as quick as it was a few weeks ago, but yeah, you can find us in all the regular places.
No promises. In the group, too. The Magic Lantern group. What about you, Matt?
The show is at The Complete Pod on Twitter. And I'm on Letterboxd as Matthew E.G. That's most of the social media I do these days. I think that's it. That's the whole thing.
That's right. Because you bailed on the
Facebook
group.
We're doing Decalogue 1 and 2. So come check that out. Josh Hornbeck is going to be our guest for the first of 6 episodes. And Cole's going to make an appearance on the awesome. Decalogue Experience. Yeah.
And when about will that little start hitting? Is next
week or two, yeah, maybe? I think we'll record next weekend. So it'll come out at some point in mid-June.
Can't wait. Maybe have a watch along. Although, again, lots to watch. So, well, I'm AWS 505, again, 20th of Frame, Masterfeed, and our social media, our Facebook group, all that stuff. Please support us in all these great shows. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks.